Good evening and welcome. My name is Carl Yeoman, and it is my honor to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Temple Grandin. Before I go forth with introducing Dr. Grandin, there is another important person here in the audience that I want to acknowledge, and that's Tristan Vermandel from the Bear Ranch Foundation, whose generous support has made this event possible. So thank you, Tristan. Dr. Grandin is here as part of the Department of Animal and Range Science at Montana State University's Bear Ranch Foundation Seminar Series, which brings national and international experts in agricultural, wildlife, and rangeland ecosystem research here to Bozeman to meet with faculty and students, as well as engage with you, the public. And so I'd encourage anyone who's interested to go onto our departmental website and have a look at the range of opportunities in addition to Dr. Grandin that you could participate in and meet with these people. Nevertheless, our speaker tonight needs very little introduction. She has degrees in both psychology and animal science and has leveraged those experiences along with her own personal experiences to become a world-recognized leader in animal behavior and welfare, wherein she's provided significant insights and technological developments that are used both throughout the US and the world for animal handling, both for safety and to lower stress. And as part of that, has leveraged her position to become a world-recognized spokesperson and advocate for autism spectrum. And so we're grateful to have her here tonight to present on both of those experiences. With no further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. Grandin to the stage.
That's really great to be here. A lot of things to talk about tonight. And one of the things is when I first started working in animal behavior, I thought everybody thought in pictures the way I did. It's been a really, really interesting journey learning that other people might think more mathematically or think more in words. And thinking in pictures, being a visual thinker, helped me understand animals. And again, I used to think everybody thought the same way I did, but they don't. And in my work with cattle, the first thing I started doing in the 70s was to get down in the chutes and see what the animals were seeing. In this particular facility, they're going right straight into the blinding sun. Might not be a really good idea to face your corrals right into the sun. Might be a real bad idea. And I remember going to two different feed yards, and they had exactly the same design of the work area. And one of them worked well, and the other worked poorly. And it had to do with direction to the sun. Now, one of the things you need to be doing is a better observer. Visual thinkers tend to notice detail. There's a lot of electronic signs now. And if there's one pixel that's wrong on that sign, I will notice it. But there's some little thing. I just instantly notice it. Orlando Airport, we walk in, and they have all the airline names on TVs, and the United Airlines lettering was a little bit scrambled on one of the signs, and I noticed it the instant I walked in. And the person I was with, I said, "Did you see that sign?" "No, they didn't." It's almost like something that shouldn't be there. Well, animals are really, really notice those sorts of things. So this is eclipse shadows. Trees act as tiny pinhole cameras. We had a 95% eclipse at Colorado State. I noticed this. I didn't know eclipses did this. I watched 100 students walk over this. This is right on the sidewalk in front of our library. They simply didn't see it. They didn't notice it. Cattle moving up to a chute, maybe there's a car parked along there. It'll make them stop. Now, if you wait long enough, they'll stop looking at the car and eventually go. If you just bring them up there and push them, they're going to turn back on you. Maybe it might be a good idea to move the car. Chains hanging down in chutes. Well, they're going to go a lot easier if you just take them out. Well, now in my books, I have checklists on these things. That's for the verbal thinkers. So now that I've learned, some people think differently. Got checklists. This particular facility at a feed yard in Australia worked really terrible because the cattle got a view of loading trucks as they came up the chute. Another facility, exactly the same, worked just fine because there was no trucks there to watch. This is what I call the dark hole cattle handling facility. And at night, if I light this up, it's going to work just fine. But on a sunny day, it's like a dark movie theater. So work really well at night, work more poorly in the day. Now, if you're willing to spend the time, let your animals maybe stand there for 30 seconds or so, you could get them to go in there. You'd have to give them time to get their eyes adjusted. Might be a lot easier to put in some white translucent panels so they can see light, so they can see light through the building. Then they'll go in easier. Now, these two objects look totally different. So if you train a horse, for example, to tolerate a blue and white umbrella, this is the work of Lehner and Fent from Germany, and the umbrella opens, horse doesn't even flinch, you train them to it, you go, oh boy, I can take flags and tarps and flap them around. No, it doesn't work. Think about it. If your memory is a picture, an umbrella looks totally different than a flag or a tarp because it's sensory-based. It's not word-based. Animal thinking is sensory-based. My thinking's not word-based. Words describe the pictures in my imagination. And I talk about that in my book, Thinking in Pictures. But it's a sensory-based world, not a word-based world. Think about a horse. You sometimes get a horse that bucks when you change gates. That's because the saddle's a different feeling picture at a walk and at a trot. Now, when I was a little kid, I was a severely autistic kid. And when I was a little kid, I liked to make things. Okay, let's say you've got somebody who's really young that has autism, a little kid. Don't let them play video games all day. Get them doing things. They got to learn how to take turns, learn how to dress themselves, learn how to go buy things in stores. Sudden new experiences, they frighten both people with autism and animals. That's where you'll see the genetics. People say, oh, my horse is fine at home, and he went berserk at the show. Well, you got a lot of new things there at the show, like flags, bikes, and balloons. Yeah, let's get them used to those things before you go to the show. Now, the thing about something that's novel is novelty is interesting when they can voluntarily approach, and it's scary when you shove it in their face. I call that the paradox of novelty. It's both attractive and scary. And where you're going to see the difference in the genetics is an Arab horse or maybe Soler cattle, some of the more flighty ones, they'll have a bigger reaction to sudden novelty than maybe a Holstein cow would have. And there's a circuit in the brain. It can oscillate back and forth between approach something and be afraid of something. Seek versus approach. It can kind of oscillate back and forth. And those circuits have been found. Now, it turns out I got a big visual thinking circuit in my head. I was very good at art as a kid. You get kids that are different in special ed. They'll be good at one thing, bad at something else. Us visual thinkers, we're going to be terrible at algebra. In fact, that's acting as a barrier to holding a lot of kids back. Visual thinkers will be often building things, designing things, making all kinds of clever equipment, and we now have a shortage of visual thinkers. Right now, we no longer know how to build a poultry processing plant. It has to be shipped over here in 100 shipping containers. We have lost the skills. We don't make elevators anymore. The elevator in the hotel I'm in is made in Germany. Really, really nicely made. And the elevator in the animal science building was just in, wasn't working quite right because you don't have anybody to fix them. Don't screen out the visual thinkers. You need us. And you need us to prevent accidents like Fukushima and stuff like that. You see, an engineer will calculate risk. The visual thinker can see it. And I can see the water filling up the basement of the nuclear reactor and drowning the electrically driven emergency cooling pump. You don't have to be an atomic engineer to know that electric pumps don't run underwater real well. And there's another visual thinking circuit. Now, the thing that I'm really bad at, and I can't multitask. A lot of kids that are different, multitasking is going to be a problem. So if I was a computer, I've got the Amazon cloud for memory, but I have to access it through a one-bar phone. So a lot of multitasking, that's going to be difficult. It's going to take some of these kids longer to learn how to drive. They need to have more practice out in a totally safe place. And you're going to have some kids that are little math whizzes. See, this is the different kinds of minds. And there's now scientific evidence that there really is different kinds of minds. You got the visual thinkers, can't do algebra. And when I was out working in the big meat plants, putting in a piece of equipment I designed called the center track restrainer system, I'm going to estimate that about 20% of the skilled designers and welders who could read drawings and build things and invent things were either autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD. I am saying that absolutely seriously. Over 30 years ago when I worked on these projects, I worked with a guy who was autistic. He had 25 patents. I know another guy. Yeah, but he's my age now. He was a stutterer, dyslexic, ADHD, terrible student, took welding, owns a big metal fabrication company. Well, the problem is these people are not getting replaced because the visual thinkers today are playing video games in the basement, and then they can't graduate from high school, so they can't do algebra. It's too abstract. Guess what? I got out of taking algebra. So how did I manage to get out of it? Because in 67, it was not the required course for college. I took probability, matrices, and statistics. They called it finite math. I had to have some tutoring, but I got through it. But we need our visual thinkers. Pork processing plant brought over here in 100 shipping containers. We still do the boilers. We still do the refrigeration, the more mathematical part that the mathematicians are going to make. But what I call the clever engineering department, we're not making that equipment anymore. And it gets down to people sticking their nose up at the skilled trades. We're in Germany, Holland, where the stuff is coming from now. You can go skilled trades. I'm talking high-end skilled trades. I'm not talking about roofing. I'm not talking about putting up sheetrock or laying down flooring or even framing houses. Talking about the real high-end skilled trade stuff. Plumbing, electrical, mechanics, people that can weld and just build equipment. That's the visual thinking department. And then you have the pattern thinkers. These are your programmers out in Silicon Valley. And let me tell you, half those programmers have autism and they avoid the labels. They all go to Montessori schools. And you go, I'm serious. I have been to Silicon Valley. I have gone into a room with 100 programmers, just at bench desks, no cubicles. It was absolutely silent, all with headphones on. And they get paid a lot of money. That's the mathematical thinker. Now, the thing is, when it comes to engineering, a visual thinker sees a solution to a problem, or sees a risk, the mathematical thinker calculates risk. In fact, there's some people that are very, very good at mathematics that have no visual thinking. It's called aphantasia, no visual thinking. Okay, then you have the verbal person, thinks totally in words. They don't understand visual thinking if they're total verbal thinker. And there's scientific evidence that this exists. It's in my book, The Autistic Brain, and I've looked up on Google Scholar, and I've found a whole bunch more, these different kinds of thinkers. Most people are kind of mixtures, but you end up with a label. You tend to be really extreme towards one way or the other. Now, this horse was terrified of black cowboy hats. He was a Mustang, BLM Mustang, and some idiot threw alcohol in his eyes, and he was wearing a black hat. White cowboy hats are fine. Black hats are scary. Now, when I put the black hat down on the ground, I got the horse to touch it. But as I took the hat and I got it closer and closer to my head, then I could feel him tensing up and he was going to rear. I got to get rid of that hat. That horse is going to rear on top of me. I don't want that. Not something I want to do. But you see, it's a picture. It's a fear memory. And one thing that's been very helpful with some of the Mustangs on helping them out has been clicker training. Because in clicker training, the horse is looking for the click. Remember, there's kind of a switch in the brain between fear and approach. Like when I put that clipboard down in that pen of cattle, they'd come up and sniff it. And the wind flaps the paper, they'd jump back. And then they'd come back up again. Now, if an animal's totally calm, he's going to be easy to handle. If you get them all fearful and excited, it takes half an hour to calm back down. And for a long time, as scientists, I wasn't allowed to use the word fear in my papers. I've got papers that talk about agitated behavior in cattle. Couldn't use the fear word. Neuroscience has been using the fear word forever. But psychologists and stuff like that, not allowed to use the fear word. And the importance of reducing fear now is being recognized at veterinary clinics. Let's make puppies' first experience at the vet clinic a good first experience. Yeah, let's do that. There's some dogs now turning gray. These are the dogs that are home alone all day, tearing up the house, jumping on everybody, don't get any exercise, and they're turning gray prematurely. This is work by my colleague Camille King, extremely hard worker. I help her design the experiments. She does all the work. Now, fear is the main emotion in autism, and it's also a big emotion in animals. Yes, I get worried about things. People ask me if I get nervous about talking. I got more nervous yesterday about an hour connection at the Denver airport. And would I have to walk from gate 90 in Concourse A to gate 90 on Concourse B? And I was calculating how long it would. That's like the two furthest apart gates in the airport. Fortunately, it came in and it was only like two gates apart. So that was nice. But I was stressing out on that one plane may come into Concourse A and the other one come into Concourse B. And it might take me 20 minutes to walk it. Would I make my connection? That's the kind of stuff I get stressed out over. Now, in dogs, we can talk about personality. One of the problems we have is that verbal thinkers lots of times call stuff a whole bunch of different things. A bold personality in a dog and low fear is the same thing. Or you might call it calm and excitable. That's the same thing as bold and shy. Shy is a word that some people like to use to describe a high fear animal, especially in the zoos. This snow leopard's really shy. Well, that means it's high fear. And a very interesting thing, there's been some interesting research on language, that when you translate words into another language, there's been some research that shows that words like mountain or river, that's really straightforward. But words for emotions vary a whole lot in different languages. Really, really interesting. And there's some interesting research now where people are still squabbling over whether or not animals are conscious. To us visual thinkers, to say a dog is not conscious is like ridiculous. Or to say it doesn't have emotions. But highly, highly verbal people, if you're using a lot of complex words to describe different emotions, you'd have a hard time understanding your dog. That's an extreme, extreme verbal thinker would think that way. And these squabbles are going on right now in top neuroscience journals. And you know what I did? I went and I wrote down all the authors' names and what their affiliations were. The psychologists, the kind of people who do counseling, highly verbal, they're more likely to deny animals' emotions than the physiologists that take brains apart. If you work on the brain, you don't deny consciousness in animals. I can tell you that right now. Okay, do they have emotions? Yes, they do. And my background, a lot of my work was in neuroscience. All right, let's look at the fact. Prozac works in dogs. The subcortical emotion systems, they are the same. The neurotransmitters are the same. Yeah, they have emotions. It's probably simpler. This is the Jack Panskep emotional systems. I really like Jack Panskep, and I've discussed this in my book, Animals Make Us Human, and this is all based on neuroscience. You have fear. So you're working with an animal or even working with a person. Which emotional system do you have? Or do you have anger? Usually with cattle, when they get upset when you handle them, it's fear. Separation distress. Separation distress. When the dog is home alone, that's separation distress. That's different than fear. It's a different emotional system. Seeking. That's the urge to explore. New Mexico State University, students put GPS collars on cattle. And some cattle would go out there and eat a lot of pasture, and others would just lay around the water hole. One was a go-getter. The other was laid back. One dog wants to chase the ball. And the other Labrador Retriever makes a good service dog because he could care less about the ball. There's now been research that shows the fetch trait. Okay, that means the same thing as seek. See, when you think visually, I'm seeing the dog fetching. I can also see the dog seeking to run after the ball. And then you have sex, and then you have the mother-young nurturing and licking, and then you have play. And both genetics and previous experience is going to affect these things. I think the difference between humans and animals, basically, is we got a computer sitting up here. So we can do complex thought in a way that animals are not going to do. Okay, here's the go-getters and the laid-back cows. You can look those up on Google Scholar. Anybody see any problem with that dog? It's in the brace position. Why don't you give it a non-slip floor to stand on? One really basic thing, cattle handling facilities and scales and stuff, is give it a non-slip floor. There's been very interesting research that's been done in the MRI scanner, and when the dog smells his favorite person, the emotion centers light up. Also, dogs differentiate in the scanner. This is some work done over in Eastern Europe, and more recent than this, between a word that means something to the dog, like maybe leash or dog park, or food, those words, or fetch, those are words that mean something. versus words like is, the, or in. That doesn't mean anything to the dog. Between meaningful words and non-meaningful words. In fact, dogs actually learn better using sensory-based stimuli rather than words. They can learn words. But I want to get you thinking about a world where you can think where there's no language. And I talk about that in my book, Animals in Translation. Visual thinking helped me understand animals. Now, do they feel pain? Yes. And I'll have ranchers say to me, oh, we castrated that calf, but it just got up and was eating grass or it drank water or whatever. You see, prey species animals, cattle and sheep, they'll cover up the fact that they hurt if they know someone's watching. Unless the animal really trusts the stock person, it's going to cover it up. Sheep are the worst about that. But animals will seek pain relief. They'll drink something that tastes really nasty to get pain relief. What do dogs need? We have bred dogs to be super, super social. This is one of my former students did that. She's now a professor. Dogs came into the animal shelter. They're all stressed out. The controls got stuck in a cage. The experimentals got to have a 45-minute period to play with Krista. And the next day, their salivary cortisol was lower. But the problem is they didn't keep doing it. So the salivary cortisol just went right back up again. What do dogs need? They need people. So at an animal shelter, they need people to come in and play with them every single day. That's what they need. Do thunder shirts work? The pressure wrap for separation distress? And what they really seemed to help on was the separation distress. And they reduced the behavior of the dogs sitting at a kennel door waiting for Camille King to come back. And they reduced the heart rate. Yeah, they seemed to work. So where did the thunder shirt idea come from? Came from my squeezing machine. When I got into puberty, I started having horrendous panic attacks. It was terrible. Colitis. That's why I was eating yogurt and Jell-O in the movie. And I watched cattle go in the squeeze chute. This is back when I was 16 years old. And I found that some of them kind of relaxed. So then I built a squeeze chute thing for myself. Squeeze machine. And as described in the Thinking in Pictures book, and you can see all the skilled trades, I built that myself. Really good skilled trades stuff there too. Now the thing is, a brain can either be more thinking or a brain can be more social and emotional. So where does the brain allocate its resources? Into thinking? You know, these computer programmers out in Silicon Valley are super smart in math, and they're not very social. And they avoid the label of autism. Half those programmers have autism, and they avoid the label. And the problem we've got with the autism diagnosis is it goes from Silicon Valley programmer, Einstein, no language till age 3, where would he be today? Thomas Edison, a hyperactive adult high school dropout. Where would some of these people be today? How about Michelangelo, a 6th grade dropout? His dad wanted him to learn Latin and write business documents, and Mikey goes, ugh, I want to go out to down to the church where they're making the art. His dad hated art. What would happen to him today? You got Beethoven, very, very, very big disability. He wrote the 5th symphony when he was partially deaf and wrote the 9th symphony in Ode to Joy when he was totally stone deaf. And he had a piano company build contraptions on his piano to help him hear. Would that happen today? Autism is an important part of my identity, but career comes first. Cattle, science, that stuff comes first. I like the logical way I think, I wouldn't want to change. But I'm seeing too many kids where they totally become their identity with autism. Also, another problem you have is autism goes from these really smart people to somebody who can't dress themselves. You got the same word, the same verbal word on this big range. Doesn't make any sense from a service provider standpoint. Verbal thinkers tend to overgeneralize. Visual thinkers solve problems by putting specific examples into categories. This is what's called bottom-up thinking. So solitary mammals provide a model for autism. That's an actual paper. African lions are more social than panthers, mountain lions, or leopards. And there's crossover genetically with autism. Does that mean a leopard's defective? No, it doesn't. You see, a certain amount of this is normal variation. You see, and I got the science here for that. And you can look it up. And then dogs are social, and their friendliness is genetically related to Williams syndrome, where you've got people that are very, very, very friendly, probably not the smartest. But they also have great talents in music. So let's take the thing that the person's good at and build on it. It could be music. It could be math. You got a little third grader who's good at math? Don't make them do boring math. Give them harder math to do. Teach them coding. Silicon Valley's short on coders right now. Take the thing they're good at and build on it. We bred a dog to be super social. So when you give a wolf or a dog a puzzle box to open to get some meat, the wolf just goes and figures out how to open it. The dog's too busy asking us for help. That's the difference. Now, the same sequences that give humans a big brain also cause autism and schizophrenia. Here's the name of a really cool paper, Genomic Trade-Offs. Are autism and schizophrenia the steep price for a human brain? Genomic trade-offs. Are autism and schizophrenia the steep price for a human brain? Making a big brain is a messy proposition. Doesn't always go right. It was in this genome experiment. My entire genome has been sequenced. Coding DNA, non-coding DNA. In the coding DNA, we found out why I have anxiety. Boom, Mendelian. Why my teeth are horrible. Yep, Mendelian. Why my skin's terrible. I've got a bleeding disorder. Don't give me too much warfarin because I'll die. That's all stuff I found out. But when it came to the autism, there's a whole bunch of little genes, and it's a true continuous trait. It's non-Mendelian, and the doctors don't want to accept that. It's a continuous trait. It's like breeding two different kinds of dogs together, and you get a dog that looks like what half and half ought to look like. You can usually tell what breeds they are. Okay, let's get back to animals. When you force animals to do stuff, you get a lot more fear stress compared to getting them to voluntarily cooperate with you. And we worked on training antelopes at the zoo to cooperate with their vaccinations, and nobody thought we could do that, but we did. And there's the antelope. Now, this animal is extremely flighty. So it took 10 days to train the antelope to tolerate a sliding door suddenly sliding up. So the first day, the door was moved an inch, and the antelope orients. You've all seen a deer do this? And when the deer orients, now the brain's making a decision. Do I seek and watch, or do I go into fear and freak out and run off? And we never pushed it past that orienting stage. Really, really important. We trained the untrainable animal. But one of the things we learned is that the doctor who had been the man with the dart gun in the past, he could never work with the antelopes. They remembered him. It didn't matter what we dressed him up in. It just didn't matter. Now, stockmanship really matters. And there's a lot of interest. I know a lot of people interested in low-stress stockmanship. There's a lot of people teaching it. Some of these people probably can handle cattle better than I can handle them. But one of the things that I want to impress upon the managers is the importance of the stockmanship. When I was young, I thought I could solve all the problems with magic equipment. When I was in my 20s, I thought I could build a self-managing cattle handling facility. That's like stupid when I look back on it. People want the thing more than they want the management. Then I started training managers. And then when things really changed, it's when I started training buyers. Things really change. But stockmanship matters, and it matters a whole lot. And people think, okay, now we've got precision agriculture coming, and that's going to just change everything. Well, you still have to manage it. Make sure an animal's first experience with a stock trailer, a new corral, with a new person, is a good first experience. Because the first experience your horse has is smashing his head on the stock trailer, it's not going to want to go in there. Make first experiences with new stuff good. A horse will also be less afraid of something if he's with a familiar person. That can help calm him down. Animals make categories. When I'm on the leash, I protect, and when I'm off the leash, I can go play. I know a truck driver, and he's got a big black dog named Millie. And when she's outside the cattle truck, she's friendly. If she's in that cab, she'll tear your arm off. And one time, a guy tried to rob him at a truck stop at night while he was sleeping, and Millie tore the guy's hand off. And you might as well put your hand in that cab, put it in a meat grinder. And Millie bit it. And he says, I better get out of here. But if she's outside the cab, she's friendly to everybody. See, that's making a visual category. Autistic kids do this, too. Here's a little boy drew boxes in his brain for separating cats from dogs. So to learn concepts such as in, on, or up and down, you've got to give them several different examples of these things because it's not abstract. Bottom-up thinking. And computers do this too. There's computers now that can diagnose melanoma skin cancer. It's trained bottom-up. You show it 2,000 melanomas, and then you show it all kinds of other skin rashes. It learns by specific example. Really important concept. But bottom-up thinking can be very useful for certain types of problem solving. I've been watching the mess with that cruise ship with all those people getting sick on it. Just awful. The first thing I would have done with that is I would have gotten a map of the ship and where were they located? I'm going to bet you they were on this inside cabins where they were sharing the air ventilation system. Don't tell me those inner rooms in that ship have independent ventilation. They don't. And so I'd start mapping it out. Was it one crew member that fed them that was making them sick? But you see, I'm visualizing it. No, I don't think anybody's taken a map of that ship and started marking down which cabins got sick. That's what I would have done, figure out how to spread it. They're worried about people leaning around the balconies, on the balcony balcony rooms. I don't think that's where it came from. I think it's on the inner cabins. I don't know. But nobody's looked at that. That's something to me that'd be obvious. Bottom-up thinking. Animals do it. People with autism do it. And computers do it. Been reading stuff on artificial intelligence. It's been really interesting. All right, let's get back to animals. Okay, you're working some animals. You got a flight zone there. You see how it's like a bubble? And the size of that bubble depends upon how wild or tame they are, their genetics, and their previous experiences. So if I enter the flight zone, they move away from me. But then you can see the tan ones looking at me. So there's two zones. There's the flight zone when they move away, and then there's a zone of awareness where they look at me. But you've got a lot of people teaching stockmanship, and for that zone outside the flight zone, some people call it the pressure zone, some people call it the zone of awareness, the zone of influence. Ron Gill at Texas A&M calls it cattle want to see you zone. That's what they call it. But if you think about it visually, those words all describe the same thing. Here's the handy-dandy way to get them to go forward. Just quickly walk back by them. Quickly walk back by them in the opposite direction. That will get them to go forward. Now, the thing is, I still have to talk about same old mistakes people make. I don't know how many people stand here, poke its butt with a paddle, expect it to go forward. And this is something I find I have to keep talking about. What I have found in stockmanship, what a lot of people have found in stockmanship, there's about 20% of the people, if you train them, they stay really good. And guess who stays really good? The dyslexics, people with autism. Oh, they're super good at this stuff. Super good. Then you got another 50% of the people that you constantly have to supervise. Constant monitoring is just like speeding out on the highway. You got to constantly monitor it. Then you have 10% that probably shouldn't be there. They like to abuse animals. And I know that's not a nice thing to say. Now, starting out in my career, I was really weird. So when you're weird, the way you sell yourself is show off your portfolio. So when I had an interview, I just would lay out the portfolio. This was my brochure. Or if it's programming, you'd show off some of your code. I sold my work, not myself. And I can tell you, being a girl in the 70s going into a man's industry was way worse than the autism. Bigger barrier. I had to work on making myself really good at what I did. And it was a lot of work. I designed the front end of every Cargill plant in North America. That's the drawing right there that I sent to Mr. Fielding in 1978. I sent him that brochure I just showed you. I sent him this drawing. And I sent him a bunch of pictures, too, and some trade magazine articles. Basically a 30-second wow. You show the work off. That's what I did. And then, at the time, I was living in the Oasis Apartments in Arizona, so I renamed it the Oasis Building, Suite 218, not Apartment 218. And there was no Google Street View to paddle on me. But you show your work off. And they look at that and they go, you drew that? Like, you gotta be kidding. Now, another thing I wanna discuss is getting into jobs the back door. Well, if you can't do algebra, you can't get in engineering the front door. But let me tell you, there's a horse trainer right now running a machine shop, and I've like put the challenge out to him. You start out in the back door just doing simple jobs, and you can work up. I've seen people in the meat industry get a job on the floor, gravitate over to the maintenance shop. 15 years later, they're building a whole big gigantic plant addition. Yep, there is a back door. I've done plenty of engineering work. I can't believe some of the dumb stuff they're doing now. They think they can do everything with virtual reality? Look at the mess they made in the main rotunda of our Denver airport under the tent. They thought they could cut holes in pre-stressed concrete beams. No, you can't, you idiots. You just can't do it. They designed something that they cannot build. Yeah, the whole interior of the main terminal's ripped up. Everything's safe. They didn't touch the building structurally. All they did is pick apart all the facings and tear stuff up in there. But they used virtual reality, but they didn't figure out how they're going to build it. This is one of the pictures Mr. Fielding got. It's really important to give animals a non-slip floor. All right, let's see how good you are at visual thinking. How many people noticed that animal's looking at the sunbeam? Raise your hands up. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff I want you saying. Now, the thing is, what used to really frustrate me is I put in really nice equipment. People do really bad things in it. Really bad things. Like on my CenterTrack restrainer system, you can look that up. Beef plant video tour with Temple Grandin. You can see how it works. I'm not going to show any slaughter stuff tonight. But one of the things that really kept things good was measuring handling. It's just like traffic on the highway. So we measure stuff like how many times they use prods and stuff like that. But people want that thing, the magic thing, more than the management. This is some measurements, feedlot cattle handling, really good data. This is the beef quality assurance from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. These are figures to be proud of for big feed yards because prod score used to be 500%. And Ruth Wallywoldy did a really nice paper on this that validated the scoring system. See, then I can tell, am I getting better or am I getting worse? Now, you got certain people that are super good stock people. They probably don't need this. But the rest of the people, just like most of the drivers out on the highway, they're going to need this. Now, when I first took some baseline data for the USDA in 1996, only 30% of the large, big plants could stun dead 95% of the cattle on the first shot. And the reason for the badness was broken equipment. The industry was shocked. Broken equipment was the reason. Then I got the power of McDonald's behind me, and things really improved. And we used that same measurement system. But I didn't shove equipment down their throat. We took some shabby old dumps and we made them work. We had to do a lot of repairs. Oh, I had broken center track restrainers out there. They busted up the hydraulics and stuff. Yeah, we made them fix that. Lots of non-slip flooring. Lots of repairs on stunners. Lighting, it's amazing what you can do with that. But out of 75 suppliers, only 3 had to build something expensive. And then 3 had to have a managerectomy. Then they got better after we got rid of the manager. This is the original temperament work my student did 25 years ago, and it was a really crazy idea to think that maybe cattle that jump around in squeeze chutes have lower weight gains. Turned out they did. But don't overslight for temperament. You might get a dull herd, it's dull, stupid cows who won't take care of a calf. Don't overselect for any trait. You will wreck your animal. Let's look at the bulldog. The breed standard says massive head. Where do you stop? It can't walk, it can't breathe, it can't have its babies naturally. They are disgusting. You want to see what a bulldog used to look like? Look up Bulldog's Dilemma, a picture from the New York Times, 1938. Bulldog's Dilemma. Look it up. Maybe they should have had a visual standard for the bulldog, a picture, and they wouldn't have gotten into such a mess. But they have a verbal standard. It says massive head. Where do you stop? We start selecting cattle just for carcass traits. And you end up with foot and leg problems. Now, the Brahmins, if you treat them right, they really like stroking. They're big on the nurture trait. And you see a horse doing something right, and then the person's hitting it. Do that to your horse. Stroke it. Stroke it. Rub it on the withers. That's what the mare does. Rub it on the withers when it does a good jump or it does something like that. Now, here are some critical control points for cattle welfare. I do have a book out there called Improving Animal Welfare, a Practical Approach. It's aimed at people that have to actually buy meat and run systems. Handling scoring, dairies, swollen leg joints. But we're getting swollen leg joints right now in beef cattle. One of the reasons is pushing the biology too hard. We're feeding like 95%. Some feed yards are really, I don't know what they're thinking of. I think they think cattle are pigs. So you feed them 95% grain, and then you grind up a little bit of hay to get about that long. We actually knew how to feed cattle in the 70s. And guess what? Things are starting to come around and realizing that maybe we were right. 15 or 20% roughage. And it's that long. Okay, lameness, I can tell. Is it getting better or is it getting worse? If somebody had said to me 20 years ago we'd have problems with lame fat cattle in feed yards, I wouldn't have believed it. But we've got them now. Body condition, you have to watch that. Heat stress. You got open mouth breathing when they're at rest, they're hot. Now, lameness is a really good thing to measure because look at all the different problems here that can make them lame. Okay, we breed for carcass. You're going to get lousy legs. Pig industry made this mistake 35 years ago. 10 years ago, cattle started repeating this mistake, and the Angus Association put in standards for leg conformation. Yeah, don't breed this. That's really hideous. That was a bull that wouldn't be able to walk. And the thing that's really disgusting is when you look at the bull ads in the magazine, why have you got fake photoshopped grass up to here? My student did a paper on the top 3 semen catalogs online. Only 19% of the pictures had fully visible feet and legs. Yeah, photoshopped grass on it. Hideous foot on a peg. Very nice non-slip floor it's standing on, but a really hideous foot. That's genetic. And I've seen cattle with a foot like that. No, you don't want to have that. Or how about crooked claw? It's a defect. Don't breed that. Let's just look at how traits are linked. This is something that's still not understood. You take a fur fox, this is the work of Belyeff, and you breed him to be gentle so he won't bite you. After a bunch of generations, you get a tame, black and white, stocky, border collie fox. Look at the difference there. The shape is different. Traits are linked. Even now, it's not fully understood how traits are linked. Be careful with what we do. Let's look at some genetic selection like this for any animal. If an animal's a country, and I put everything into the economy, like carcass and growth or milk, I shortchange my infrastructure. It's going to be bone, feet and legs, heart. We've got hideous, disgusting heart defects in feedlot cattle now. Hideous hearts. I was just in a plant in December, and there's a nice little lady that works for my student that's working in that plant now, and I introduced her to liver abscesses and heart defects. Next thing I know, pictures are coming off the slaughter floor of this really gross heart. I'm going, I don't know how this animal managed to walk up the ramp. The heart's so messed up. So you have your infrastructure, then you have military immune. So you've got the economy, things you want production. You've got the infrastructure that keeps the animal together and immune, military, to fight off disease. You put it all into the economy, you got nothing left for infrastructure or military. So let's say you breed an animal that will have all these things. You'll have to feed it some very high-octane stuff. The fast-growing chickens we have now, they've solved some of the leg problems, but you have to feed them synthetic methionine or they fall apart. There's always a trade-off. 20 years ago, you wouldn't be able to get in a pen with farmed deer like this. That's 30 years of selection right there. Here's what the bulldog on used to look like. That's what it looks like now. That's the picture of the bulldog's dilemma. How'd you get to that monstrosity from that? That's what I call bad becoming normal. It happens slowly. And one of the reasons why I've noticed a lot of problems is when I go to the slaughter plant, or excuse me, the harvest facility, or if you're in Europe, it's the abattoir, the abattoir. That word's getting more and more common. But I'd see animals from lots of different sources right next to each other. 35 years ago, when the pig industry started selecting for lean, rapidly gaining pigs, they got very excitable pigs that bit tails. Nobody deliberately breeds vicious pigs, but they managed to do that. And the breeders were mad at me for noticing that. Because when I went to the meat plant and saw their pigs next to another bunch of pigs, the amount of bitten tails, I mean, that was obvious. Isn't that disgusting? A little bit of a dish face is pretty. That's hideous. That's gone too far. Now let's look at welfare. We got to prevent suffering. But the thing I want to ask you is the animal have truly a positive life? I think beef cattle up here, they probably got a pretty decent life. These are some of my textbooks, Improving Animal Welfare, Practical Approach. If you're actually going to be working on running a sustainability or animal welfare for a large corporation, you're going to want that book because it doesn't get into all the philosophy. It gets into how do I set up an auditing program? How do I make sure that my suppliers do the stuff they need to be doing? Okay, well, let's just get a few questions. Most valuable thing I've learned, I actually learned it really early. I learned it after I had a project really mess up on me. You can't solve pig genetics problems with conveyors. It doesn't work. And the mistake I made when I first started out is I thought I could fix everything with an engineering solution, with a piece of equipment. Now, there's a lot of things I can fix with equipment, but I can't replace management with equipment. I tried to do that. It was a gigantic mistake. Don't do that. I don't care what you're using the equipment for. Equipment doesn't replace management.
Hi. First, thank you for visiting here in Bozeman, Montana. Presentation was terrific for all of us. I do have one question that I've had for a very long time, and that is typically we look at folks on the spectrum, and we don't really talk about how we need them and not just they need us.
Well, you see, the things with a person on the spectrum is I'm an extreme visual thinker. Most so-called normal people are somewhere in the middle, or an extreme mathematical thinker. And you need us visual thinkers. Let's look at the Boeing Max mess. Okay, the thing that brought the planes down, the first thing, was a visual thinking mistake. The angle of attack sensor broke. And when it broke, the plane thought it was stalling when it wasn't. And the pilot hopelessly pulled back on the yoke and he couldn't fight the computer. I would never trust a single sensor. The thing's the size of a Sharpie pen. It measures air angle. Delicate little thing. A bird can just rip it off a plane. Normally, they're just aids for the pilot. They're not wired to anything except an indicator on the instrument panel. They wired it right into active flight controls and did not tell the pilots. Now, when you think about it visually, that's very simple. Okay, so if I break this thing, all right, what does it do? Maybe the default mode should be fly normally when I break it, not stall. Now, there's other things, too. Wall Street got too involved with Boeing. I'm not a big fan of the financial sector because they don't make things. And they sort of sucked the blood out of Boeing. And they wanted to save money, so they took the old 737 body and grafted these big, huge, energy-efficient engines on it. So it wasn't the most stable aircraft. That's what you call a kludge design. But if they hadn't made the mistakes with the angle of attack sensor and their computer programming, why did you program it to just keep shoving it down so many times? I can tell you, Captain Sullenberger tried out the simulator that was set up to mimic that accident. Sully walks out of there, and this is the guy who landed on the Hudson. He walks out of there and he goes, that thing's a death trap. He wasn't very happy about it. Now they're in trouble because they found a ladder inside the tail of a plane. Oh, come on. Dirt in the gas tanks? What's going on here? That's pushing and rushing and doing things sloppily. You need us visual thinkers because we're going to see stuff like that. You had a ladder inside the tail? There's all kinds of very important flight critical mechanics inside the tail. I don't want a ladder in it. I know, I can just imagine what it might be doing. Stop the control surfaces from working. You see, that's something I can visualize. I can't do the mathematics to design an airplane, but you still need a visual thinker. I can't believe they trusted a single delicate sensor. That violates every rule in engineering. Those planes would probably be up there still flying around if they hadn't made that mistake. And then a ladder in the tail, that's just sloppiness. Getting back to how bottom-up thinking works. When I did my TED talk 10 years ago, there'd been a bunch of wrecks. And when it was not weather, it was not pilot error, I could put one word on it, tail. Either fell off or the steering broke. That was like 5 accidents, so a bunch of really serious accidents. You see, that's bottom-up thinking. I'm trying to see what is the common denominator when it was not weather and it was not pilot error.
I'm a student over at Carroll College in Helena, and I'm studying anthrozoology, which is the study of human-animal interactions.
Okay.
And I'm also studying psychology. And my question, I suppose, is does your work, do you think that it relates to the field of anthrozoology being that human and animal interactions?
Yeah, it does relate.
Do you think it could grow into perhaps more connections happening as things just continue in life? Do you think that anthrozoology could become even bigger than it is now because it's an ever-evolving study?
All right, what you see, get out in the field. I gave a talk at the Green Biz meeting. That's where all the sustainability officers for big companies like Dow and Cargill, they were all there. A lot of the talk was very abstract. You see, what I did with the slaughterhouses, I picked out something I could put my head around. I mean, fixing slaughterhouses and just one part of them. That's not the whole world. You see, verbal thinkers tend to really, really overgeneralize. And one of the things I told them was to get the suits out of the office, find out what's going in the field. I also thought it was very interesting. Okay, beef's getting attacked for being evil horribleness. Now, there's a lady there from Cargill, and she said the number one sustainability issue they had was soy. It was their biggest problem. Can't track the stuff. You got people growing soy, digging up the pastures in Argentina. That's not sustainable. Soy's not all that great. Then I thought about, been thinking about since design slaughterhouses, got to justify, you know, eating cattle, having them. And I've been learning more and more about regenerative agriculture and using animals with the land, with crop rotation. I'm getting interested in that. They're part of the land. So I thought of something we can do with the Impossible Burgers supply chain. Their top 3 ingredients are soy, peas, and sunflower oil. How about some nice cattle on a cover crop for 4th rotation for soil health? Yeah. The Impossible Burger supply chain. when I talk about it, it's not abstract. Then I sat at a little round table on debris in the plastics in the ocean. You know what? I was shocked that I knew more about it than they did. I read Science and Nature. See, my approach, okay, if we got floating garbage gyres, what's in the garbage gyre? Well, there's a lot of fishing gear in that. Well, okay, that's something I can put my head around. Let's work with the fishing industry and not let their nets and their floats and stuff get away from them. You see, that's something I can actually do something about, fishing gear. You see, and that's not abstract. I can see it. And it's also a problem that's somewhat doable.
As a pioneer of this field, what advice do you have for women going into agriculture?
Well, right now, and then it's going to be a lot easier. There's lots of girls in agriculture now. And be really good at what you do. I talked to a lady just last year. She was in the crop industry. And I've got to make it vague because I can't identify these people. But she was having a lot of trouble with the guys. And she worked for a company that did a lot of ag consulting. And she was very, very good at one particular thing to do with growing crops. I said, you make yourself so good at this that when their butt gets in a pile of trouble, you come in and save it. You make yourself the absolute best. That's what you do. You got to be better than a guy. I was really appalled at the amount of guys that could mess up a job. How about somebody who made a $20 million mistake where a meat plant had to close? He was told by every engineer he did not have enough wastewater treatment. He went ahead with it anyway. It closed. That was early 90s, a real mess. When I was young, I thought everybody was a visual thinker. I didn't know. All through my 20s, I didn't know. And then when I wrote my book, Thinking in Pictures, I didn't know fully. And then I keep learning. And then in the Autistic Brain book, my book, The Autistic Brain, that's when I started figuring out that there's a picture thinker, it's called an object visualizer. There's a mathematical thinker, that's called visual spatial. And then there's the word thinker. There are these different kinds of thinking, and we need them because they complement each other. For example, Steve Jobs, probably on the spectrum, but don't put the A word on Stevie when you go out to Silicon Valley. They don't want that. They inspected a slide I had for that. My slides got inspected. And an artist made the interface on an iPhone. That's why it's easy to use. Everybody else copied it. The mathematicians had to make it work. But if the mathematicians had made the interface, the phone would have been a dud because it would have been too hard to use. You see, that's a different minds working together. I have a lot of co-authors on my book because as a visual thinker, I'm kind of scattered. I need that verbal thinker to make it more linear. You see, that's different minds working together and complementing, where the skills complement. This is really important.
I'm another student of anthrozoology.
Okay.
And so first of all, I'd like to say it's such an honor to see you in person. So thank you so much for coming out.
Well, it's great to be here.
My question for you is, what do you think your biggest accomplishment in animal welfare has been?
I think the thing that made the biggest difference wasn't equipment. It was the little scoring system. The thing I used to evaluate it. But the trick is, how do you pick out the five things I scored? I scored percentage stunned dead on the first shot. And then when you hang them up on the rail, everything has to be dead. Vocalization during handling. Like you squash them with a restrainer device, you're hurting them. Poke them with a prod, they'll make them move. Vocalization scoring in the stunning area was a super good measurement for finding bad stuff. Falling down and electric prod use, and then with six acts of abuse. But how do you pick the five things that are most important? Those are called critical control points. All right, let's go back to traffic. If you could only enforce three things in traffic, which three things would you enforce for maximum public safety? Drunk driving, speeding, red light and stop sign violations, and then the other two is going to be seat belts and texting. If I just enforce those five, I'm going to get 95% of my public safety. That's a critical control point. You see, and then on the other welfare stuff, lameness, you can have like 10 different things that make cattle lame. Lameness is a critical control point. And we held the plants to their numbers. And they knew what they had to do. It wasn't vague gobbledygook written in bureaucratic language where nobody knows what it means. It was totally straightforward. And the other thing that made it work is I did not shove equipment down their throat. I bent over backwards to do reverse conflict of interest and make whatever piece of junk there they work. Some of the junky facilities, I made them work. Repairs and non-stop flooring, we had to do that. And management, supervision of employees. Now, it's amazing what you can do with lighting, too. Indoor facilities, just amazing. But people look at the equipment. Now, if I had a choice, between some places got adequate equipment, just old-fashioned adequate equipment, but really good management, I'll take that over state-of-the-art equipment and bad management. That's what I'll do. And it took a long time for me to learn that. Okay, you don't have a mic, so you taught special ed for 10 years, okay?
One of the things that I've noticed in my 10 years of teaching is that more and more parents are trying to get their kids on the spectrum because they don't understand why their child is acting the way they're acting.
I tell you, the special ed department builds the stuff. I went to Cape Kennedy 2.5 years ago. There's a brand new launch pad there. The head of the project had Tourette's. I'm serious. The special ed department builds the clever engineering department. But you need me, because I found something in that launch pad that wasn't supposed to be there. And it might jeopardize the mission. I watched a raccoon come out of it and walk down the steps and go into the bushes. And nobody else saw it. And I go, what have you been chewing and eating? Yeah, that matters. You need us too, even though we can't do algebra. But I'd be going around in that launch pad. He's going to eat things people have touched. And if there's a circuit box open where the wiring's been really touched, he's going to chew that because it'll have salt on it, people's hands.
But have you seen more of an increase in the diagnosis?
Let's talk about the increase in autism. I think a lot of that's increased detection. In my generation, social rules were taught in a much more rigid way because the autistic mind has to be taught how to behave in different situations. Also, they're not learning how to work. I'm seeing a lot of granddads come up to me. They find out they're autistic when the kids get diagnosed. I've got books out there by adults that get diagnosed later in life. But they had a paper out at 11 and they learned how to work. I'm seeing too many parents where the kid's becoming a label. They're not learning shopping. And now we've got a label that goes from geniuses at Silicon Valley to somebody who can't dress themselves. That's where the verbal thinkers, they went overgeneralized on that. All right, I think what we're going to do, I think we're going to end it there. And thank you all for coming, and I'll be out there in the lobby.
You have just heard a lecture titled Understanding Animal Behavior and Autism by Colorado State University's Department of Animal Science professor, Dr. Temple Grandin, before an enthusiastic audience at Bozeman's Ellen Theater. The free public event was sponsored by the Bear Ranch Foundation and MSU Bozeman's Department of Animal and Range Sciences as part of the Bear Ranch Foundation seminar series. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded on the evening of February 20th, 2020, and produced by Joy LaClaire for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM, Bozeman.